This episode of the Python Perspective is brought to you by life insurance. Life insurance, like all insurance, it's a big scam, but somehow thought of as necessary in a world where it's impossible to pay for circumstances during an emergency. Welcome to The Apartment Complex, a one-off minisode hosted by The Python Perspective. On the 60th anniversary of the original release of Billy Wilder's film The Apartment, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me again is Anna, environmental scientist and analyst. Welcome, Anna.
Hello, Ben.
50 years ago is how we normally start the podcast, by saying 50 years ago today, something came out. But instead, we are dealing with something that is older than our normal half century of perspective. 60 years ago, on June 30th, in 1960, the film The Apartment went into wide release. It had come out in a New York City premiere on, I believe, June the 14th, and then had its LA premiere on June the 21st. And the film has gone on to pretty great success. It was listed as number 6 all-time comedies by The Guardian in an article that came out in, I want to say, 2010. When they were doing lists of all sorts of different genres, ranking the top 10 of different things, just missed the top 5. We traditionally talk about comedies on this podcast, but we are dealing with a romantic comedy or a romance. Anna, is this a comedy?
Yeah, I think part of what makes this movie really special is that it is a genre bender. People who want a romantic comedy can find that, but people who want something a little deeper can probably find that too. People who want something very dark will not be disappointed either.
Yeah, there's that fabulous line where Bud recognizes the cracked compact mirror and he says,
"The mirror, it's broken."
"Yes, I know. I like it that way. Makes me look the way I feel."
And I'm like, oh, I am 17!
I know!
I love that line!
Yeah, it hit deep.
I mean, I feel silly still responding to something quite that goth, but at the same time, it really makes me happy every time I watch it.
Yeah, I thought that was like so, I don't know, it felt very edgy for something
yes.
that came out in 1960.
Well, edgy, I think, is one of the fascinating things about this film. It's a film that is a comedy about suicide.
Mm-hmm.
It's a comedy about adultery. And its main through lines are people cheating on their wives, someone enabling people to be terrible people, blackmail, and the persistent, repeated possibility that somebody who has attempted suicide once, which is both of our characters,
mm-hmm.
might do it again. And lying are the major engines of action and character decisions in this film, which doesn't sound like the basis of a comedy.
Absolutely. I think the first, say, 25 to 35 minutes of this movie, I hated it. And then I started to see what was happening and what was unfolding. And I started to realize that actually this movie was incredibly ahead of its time. At first, I thought that our main character was complicit. And then I realized the direction that the story was going, and not to get too ahead of where I think we're, you know, we may want to take the discussion, but I think that for me, I couldn't help but think of Mad Men. I'm sure that a lot of other people do when they watch this, but you know, that wasn't until 2007, I think, Mad Men came out. And this was sort of like a movie about, you know, the same things that Mad Men was about, but during the era that it was happening, and really like pointing a finger at all of these, the injustices of that era in the midst of it. When I first started watching the movie, like, and I don't really care for Jack Lemmon and the I think that was another aspect of it that right off the bat I was like, I don't know. I don't know about this guy. Like, what's his deal?
So some background for our listeners. Anna, you and I had discussed the possibility of doing an episode about the Out of Towners, which celebrated its 50th anniversary on May 28th, and which I had believed was a significant and well-regarded comedy. And the two of us watched it individually on our distant coasts and then reported back to each other and sort of said, that wasn't very good. I had expected much more of a Neil Simon script with Jack Lemmon as the comic foil, and it took me about half the movie to warm up to where I finally understood what it was doing. But you went through that film diligently and then
I
told
did my
me
best, yeah.
that you did not think that it was a good idea for us to talk about it, especially as a comedy. It didn't really work for you.
Yeah, it did not hold up well. And I think that interestingly enough, I think the process of going through that, watching that movie and then watching this movie really did highlight how beautiful the movie The Apartment is, and how well it does hold up and how important it is as a movie. By comparison to other movies, you know, obviously the other movie was made, you know, 10 years later, so it's a little bit different in tone, and what it was trying to convey is certainly a lighter movie than The Apartment, which you know, has the weight and complexity of a satire. But I am very glad that we watched another movie. But I think that when I was in those like starting, you know, 20 to 30 minutes, I was like, you know, Jack Lemmon has this energy that is hard to take seriously for me. Not that we're necessarily supposed to take comedy seriously, but I think that by the end we do. We are supposed to.
Can you briefly sum up what you think his energy is?
What I don't like about them is his unrelatable neurotic energy, that he is responsive to situations in a way that I think is not just irritating, but also I don't see a lot of people having, and also I'm supposed to find funny.
Now, I'm really glad you brought this up. There is there's a scene in the first third of the film where Lemon gets in the elevator with Miss Kublik. We've basically seen her twice at this point. We've met her in the elevator the first time after Mr. Kirkaby and Jack Lemmon have met up in the lobby and pretended that they don't know each other. They get in the envelope in the elevator, get in the envelope, get in the elevator and head upstairs. And that's our first real introduction to Miss Kublik as character.
Morning, Mr. Kirkaby.
Morning, Miss
Good
Kublik.
morning, Mr. Baxter.
Why, Miss Kublik?
That's all. Take it away.
Watch the door, please. Blasting off.
And then we see her again when he's going up to meet Mr. Sheldrake on the 29th floor about a possible promotion. And he is manic.
Hi, 27, please. Drive carefully. You're carrying precious cargo. I'd be manpower-wise.
When he talks to her, he's got his cold, first of all, but he's also energized about the possible promotion. He's been juggling all the different appointments of the four men in the office that use his apartment, and he has jumped from the first elevator that opened his doors to the elevator with Miss Kubelik in it because he's smitten with her. And I found him so trying, so cloying, so too much during that scene.
You may not realize it, Ms. Kubelik, but I am in the top 10, efficiency-wise, and this may be the day, promotion-wise.
You're beginning to sound like Mr. Kirkaby already.
Well, why not, now that they're kicking me upstairs?
And it never really struck me before. In this particular rewatch, I was like, oh, you're not an attractive man at all in this scene.
He's a goober.
Yeah. And so I wondered if you thought that is part of an arc for him? That over the course of the film, he becomes less aggressively performative with her as they get to know each other? Or what are your takes on his character? What is he in that scene? How does he stop being obnoxious?
Yes. Yeah, no, I think it is part of an important arc. I think, again, at the beginning, because, you know, we had watched The Out-of-Towners, and he has, this is a, you know, sort of like a Jack Lemmon thing, right? That he has this energy that's, this like comedic, fast-paced, you know, sort of annoying on purpose. You know, so he's sort of cast into that and plays on that with this character. But I think that you're absolutely right. I think what Billy Wilder is trying to do, is it Wilder?
I don't believe anybody in America pronounced it that way.
No one.
But I recognize that, yes, there is a desire to want to ethnicize.
I just, you know, I was reading about him and I just didn't know. So I thought you'd probably know.
Everyone pronounces it Wilder.
Okay. So that, yes, the part of what is happening with his character is this initial response, you know, where I'm like, this guy's complicit. And he goes from being this person who's like, yeah, like whatever you say. He's trying to climb his way up, which is, I think, relatable. But he never says no. He's bending over backwards. He has desires of his own, but they are so far down the list of things that he's prioritizing that he doesn't really know who he is. And then throughout the course of the movie, we do see a transformation in him. And I think that that is one of the driving forces of the plot. I think that he's still annoying at the end. And I think that there's things that, you know, if this movie was remade today, I think that they would change a lot about his character. I think that they would display those traits in him differently than they did at that time. There's a scene where he's talking to Miss Kubelik and he's like, oh, I know everything about you.
A couple of months ago, I looked up your card in the group insurance file. I know your height, said your weight, and your social security number.
It's very alarming in a modern context.
Yes.
It is.
Yes.
It is not. And she kind of like smiles and shrugs and she's like, oh, like that's, you know, aren't you funny? But don't tell anyone else that you know that because they would get the wrong idea.
Right. If you knew that I had an appendix scar, people would wonder why you've seen that particular part of my torso.
Don't mention the appendix to the fellas in the office, okay? I wouldn't want them to get the wrong idea about how you found out.
Exactly. And that is the way that the movie handles that particular exchange of information. You know, in a modern context, it's horrifying. It would be like, how, like, why do you know this stuff about me? You're really creepy. You're stepping over a boundary that everyone should know is inappropriate.
Yeah, he basically Google stalked an employee in his building.
Yeah, and the fact that he's like exuberantly telling her this as though it's not only not at all shameful, but something that he's like excited to share with her, that he knows all of this stuff about her. And she has no reaction at all. It's the way that Shirley MacLaine plays this character. She's so collected and inside of herself. I could even see that character being really concerned and bothered by that moment and that revelation, but sort of holding it in. She is that self-contained. Gosh, this is just like another thing that I really like about this movie. It's the way that I see a lot of women having to respond to uncomfortable moments where she's not like, wow, it's kind of disturbing that you looked at my personal information. Like, why do you think that's okay? She's not confronting him. She's accepting it. She's smiling. She's like deflecting. She's saying like, okay, but like, don't tell anyone about my scar because like, they're going to get the wrong idea. Wink. And she's neither like leading him on, nor is she shaming him or making him feel uncomfortable. It's sort of this like right down the middle behavior that I see still with a lot of women where it's like, don't rock the boat, just move the conversation forward.
So that's what you mean by collected, that she is circumscribed by her role in society. She knows she's an elevator girl. She knows that she has to deal with a certain amount of abuse because she's a woman. Am I hearing you?
Yeah, yes, okay. yes. And so I think that it's like, it's something that I see people do not necessarily have to act that way, but it's something that I see people do still act that way when there's like these, you know, I think maybe the closest word for this that people would you know, agree to is like a microaggression, you know, where people are like sexualizing someone, you know, like even, you know, our protagonist Bud is like, hey, like, do you want to go out with me? You're super cute. You know, he's just sort of like coming on to her all the time. People in the elevator, you know, they're ogling her, they're making sexual comments. I think this is really common for all kinds of people in our culture in different ways all of the time, whether it's like women about their sexuality or other parts of themselves. The way that so many people cope is to just be extremely self-contained, deflect it in some way, and move the conversation forward. And I found that part of the movie to be incredibly accurate, whether or not Billy Wilder meant to capture that. Probably Shirley MacLaine did. I found her to be absolutely magnetic, as I'm sure everyone does.
So she's roughly 25 at the filming of this movie. And I assume her character is also about her age, maybe 24. There's a line when her brother-in-law comes to collect her from Baxter's apartment. And he says,
"It's none of my business what you do, Fran. You're over 21, but your sister happens to think you're a lady."
And over 21, under 24... like, that's an interesting age range in terms of experience in the world. And, of course, she has the conversation over gin rummy about previous boyfriends. She talks about being cursed, that her first kiss was in a graveyard, and she's had a couple of bad boyfriends since then.
Last one was the manager of a finance company back home in Pittsburgh. They found a little shortage in his accounts, but he asked me to wait for him. He'll be out in 1965.
We're not explicitly told so, but we're supposed to, in my opinion, have a sense of her as being a little experienced but pretty naive. And so it's interesting that you find that she is effectively contained in that office, especially considering that we also have the conversation between Kirkaby and Baxter, where Kirkaby basically says,
"She just won't give me a tumble, date-wise.
Maybe you're using the wrong approach."
"Yeah, a lot of guys around here have tried it. All kinds of approaches. No dice."
She's been hit on by man after man after man in this building, which we're told employs thousands and thousands of employees. And there is this sense that the women who work there are there for the eventual pleasure and affairs of the men who work there. And so Baxter is part of that culture. Mm-hmm. Whether he acknowledges it or not, he is riding the same train of, "You are available to me," and when he asks her out.
Right.
Which is sad on a lot of levels that he doesn't understand that.
Yeah, and I think in that way, this movie is not transformative for him. I hate that because I think that I had hoped to talk about this movie in the ways that I liked it very much. And I still mean to do that here today. But yeah, I think that I would not want to miss that about this movie, which is that it is very much embedded in the structure of its time. And this protagonist, for whatever transformation he does go through and for whatever good he does do in the movie, it never gets out of that essential structure. Even this like idea of like, well, it's a romance movie. Not everyone is going to see it that way. For some people, it's just going to be like, ugh, come on. He, you know, has this like captive audience of this poor girl who's like clearly in a crisis. And then he like tries to swoop in on her at her most delicate of times, you know.
So much so that when the doctor next door says it's got to take her 24 hours to get it out of her system,
"She'll sleep on and off for the next 24 hours. Of course, she'll have a dandy hangover when she wakes up. Just as long as she's okay."
He lies to her and says, "You've got to stay for 48 hours.
I really should be getting home. My family will be flipping by now."
"Well, you can't leave yet. The doctor said it takes 48 hours to get that stuff out of your system."
Oh my gosh.
Just so that he can grab a little bit more time with her.
I didn't even notice that part.
He's basically, you know, well, I mean, he's in love with her, but he's manipulating her. He's lying to her. He's trying to get her to stay. I don't think he has any ulterior motives beyond just being in her presence, but at the same time he is, and it's never directly addressed that, but that's also the reason he gets punched out, is because they cross the line of when she should have gone home and nobody really would have noticed. He pushes the boundaries and therefore gets the pavement for it.
Yes, I think that there's like a tension here that we're discussing between like what was sweet in 1960 about like, you think you're in love with somebody that you don't really know and you're taking care of them, and that can turn into like a very cute romantic comedy by the end. Whereas in 2020, it's actually very annoying to look up somebody's personal information to keep them against their will by means of telling them that they should be with you for 48 hours instead of 24, and to potentially emotionally prey on them while they are in an unstable emotional state after their attempted suicide. So I think that in light of the changing contexts, a lot of people could really have a problem with this in a romantic comedy context.
Well, people did at the time. Reviews were very, very mixed. Critical acclaim for this movie, it was not consistent. It has built its reputation as a great romance. But at the time, people thought that Baxter was not a likable protagonist. And they did glom onto the fact that he is a craven liar, constantly lying to everybody, always taking a circumstance and twisting it to a little bit of an advantage. Sometimes he's doing it to protect other people. Sometimes he's doing it for himself. But he is always twisting the truth in order to get something out of it. He turns around. At the end of the film, she comes back to him, but he was ready to quit his job, make a stand, do the right thing, leave without her. He'd made all these decisions that he needed to be a better man on his own. The film rewards him for it, but he wasn't going to be rewarded.
And what do you think about that?
Well, right before I watched this movie, I rewatched When Harry Met Sally.
Interesting. This is not where I thought you were going to go with that.
And I think I have this straight, that in early drafts of When Harry Met Sally, they wanted the characters not to get together at the end.
Mm.
And I bring this up particularly because When Harry Met Sally has the scene on New Year's Eve where a person rushes through the city in order to get to the person they want to be with in a final climactic truth-telling. I went to the website TV Tropes to try and find out if this was the first version of that thing that ends up becoming this massive trope of the I'm rushing through the airport in order to stop you from leaving in order to profess my love that shows up in so many things. But this film is the basis for cliche. So many other films imitate and emulate what this film achieves and accomplishes in those final moments. TV Tropes points out that the rush to tell the truth about how you feel ending is in Billy Wilder's two previous films. It's basically in Some Like It Hot, and it's in 1954's Sabrina. And so this was a type of a rising action ending that Wilder was really establishing. And prior to that, the major event of what TV Tropes calls the Race for Your Love ending occurred in a 20-minute chase scene in Harold Lloyd's 1924. I cannot read my own handwriting, so I'm going to think that says Girl Shy. Maybe? We'll find out later. Corrections department, write in. So the tension of not having them end up together is a particular reaction to movies that have people end up together. When you have one of my favorite romances of all time, Broadcast News, end with the love triangle with the three different characters all being involved with three other people, like real relationships in the real world, where you have a mad, passionate attraction to somebody, and then nothing happens and you marry somebody 6 years later. That's what happens in life. That doesn't happen very often in movies. And I love the fact that it happens in Broadcast News. It is a useful touchstone to me.
We'll talk about that next time.
Yeah, off Skype. We'll talk about that. So I think it's important that the movie establishes that Jack Lemmon learned enough that he was going to do something without the reward. And I think then the audience is rewarded by going, oh, good, because otherwise we're going to leave feeling like, well, that was crappy. I want pretty people to kiss each other. That's what people go to movies. So they want to see pretty people locked in an embrace.
Yes, I think that we are so entrenched in this like loop of needing that kind of closure. Can you do anything without a focus group? I mean, probably. I don't I don't even know if that was, what was driving this kind of thing back then.
All right. Well, I know I just talked for like 7 minutes about romance movies, so I will try to keep this short. But I did some digging on the Motion Picture Production Code of 1930, otherwise known as the
Hays
Code, correct?
Yes. Oh, I got it. Do I get a point on the quiz later?
100%. Yes. You get a 3 points.
Yes.
On the quiz later for knowing that the Hays Code.
Thank you.
The The reason I was particularly paying attention to the Hays Code is because I think that this movie exists in part because Wilder made it after Some Like It Hot.
Mm.
Some Like It Hot was a crazy production, in part because Marilyn Monroe is one of the hardest actresses to work with, apparently. I found an interview with her in 1958 where she basically says, "I require an enormous amount of work to do simple stuff. I know it." And this was right when she was about to go make Some Like It Hot, that she was already acknowledging the fact that she's not good at line readings, she's not good at details, she's late, she shows up whenever, and then she trusts her inherent appeal to win people over and have them forgive her. The filming of Some Like It Hot was very difficult, and then it was released without a rating because it violated the production code all over the place. One of the key things that is forbidden in the production code, which feels hilarious to me from a modern perspective, is you can't have Tommy guns. Machine guns were outlawed according to the Hays Code, period. And so the fact that they have all these mobsters running around shooting the crap out of people would have been enough. But then they have implications of homosexuality. They have a see-through dress that she has been sewn into. They have all these moral problems. And the production code is very much based on morality. Mm-hmm. In the initial 1930 establishment, in this article that I've got in front of me from History Matters, no picture shall be produced that will lower the moral standards of those who see it. Basically, they were saying you can't do anything that is divergent in any way. And then films were like, well, what the hell do we make movies about? And they constantly pushed against it. And so, according to the commentary track from the Blu-ray of The Apartment, Wilder directed the film with the key idea that he wanted the film to be as he pictured it, and nobody could mess with it. And so it was very carefully written and shot so that they could get around the fact that they were talking about adultery, which was against the code. That they mention, without mentioning it, abortion. When the doctor comes in while the brother-in-law is in the apartment.
What does he mean, accident?
Well, these things happen all the time.
What things? Say, what kind of a doctor are you anyway?
Not that kind of doctor.
What kind of trouble was she in? And the words abortion are never mentioned, but everybody watching that scene knows. Everything's in code in this film. It's very much walking the knife edge of what you can and can't get away with.
I really like when the doctor's wife, she's in Bud's apartment.
You wouldn't have such a thing as a napkin, would you?
Well, I have some paper towels.
Beatnik.
I was like, yes, beatnik. And he's not, as far as I can tell, except that he strikes his pasta with a tennis racket, which is awesome. Yeah, I just loved this sort of wink to that era, which was sort of simultaneously going on behind the scenes of this insurance company lifestyle, right. You know, where everybody's in these high rises working the, what was it, the 8:50 to 5:20 shift.
Right.
And trying to climb their way up to this executive suite to get their adultering lifestyle going. It was a very sweet moment. I love that was an insult over not having napkins.
Bud's apartment is fascinating in that it does show that he is not a serious man. He doesn't have the ability to strain his pasta when he cooks it, so he has a tennis racket that does it for it, as opposed to getting the right tool for the job. He doesn't have cloth napkins because he doesn't entertain. He doesn't have people over because he doesn't cook. He makes TV dinners. He is just as bad, for example, as the terrible woman that Mr. Kirkaby wants to bring home, who doesn't want to go out with him on a Thursday night because that's when she stays in to watch The Untouchables. The very concept of the TV dinner is this appalling idea of you're making a ready-made meal just in order to be able to tap out and watch television. And what does he do when he watches television? He has four channels that he cycles between during the ads, like all of us do. It's just putting off life, which is what the dominant metaphor with the doctor is, where he brings up the idea that you're treating your life like it's a credit card.
I don't know what you did to that girl in there, and don't tell me, but it was bound to happen the way you carry on.
Live now, pay later. Diners Club.
I do like that, but I also think that the doctor was referring to a perception that he had about Bud and not necessarily his reality. The idea that he was burning the candle at both ends.
But he also has no real art on his walls. He has posters that have been tacked to the walls. Prints of modern art where he's attempting to be cultured, but he still doesn't have anything real. He just has them thumbtacked to the wall.
Interesting. I wonder how much of that was like also a conscious decision. I heard that Billy Wilder like even used some of his own furniture and furniture from thrift stores to dress the apartment, which it must have been such a process, like a very thoughtful decision, like everything to put on that set because so much of the important parts of the movie were shot there. I would really like to go back and watch those scenes again and see what I think. I think watching it like in black and white on my laptop was probably not the I mean, obviously it's in black and white, but it's easy to gloss over some of the details when I'm watching it for the first time. And I would be curious to sort of look again at what I think of what's in the apartment. And it's very easy for me to glamorize anything that is in New York in 1960 and just think that it's very cool. Which is another reason why I love this movie. I thought that the music was so great and the scenes, like every scene was so beautiful and cool, and the holiday scenes were so great and the party scenes were so great. I think I read a quote of yours in an article where you talked about watching this movie every year between Christmas and New Year's, and that's one of the thoughts that I had while I was watching this. I'm always on the prowl for unconventional holiday movies, and man, does this fit the bill. Like, even though it features a suicide prominently in its plot, I think that it captures this thing. You know, you talk about this movie as source material for some of the, you know, common tropes in romantic comedies, and I think that this is, you know, another thing where we see these you know, loving portrayals of New York at Christmas. And you know, this is it, like just this beautiful like nostalgia before it was nostalgia about New York. I you know, I say this every time, but I can't wait to watch it again.
I've never lived in New York. I've only ever visited New York. It is a hugely complicated ecosystem that I don't think I understand. For example, I don't know what it means to have an apartment on the Upper West Side. I know that that's where his apartment is. When he gives the address to Mr. Sheldrake to bring Miss Kubelik there, he gets in a cab and he says, West 51st Street. And it's a block away from Central Park, he tells us in the introduction. And there's a blog by a gentleman named Nick Carr, who's a location movie scout, where he goes through finding the actual location of the exterior of that apartment, as well as the other exteriors that were filmed in New York City. And it's a really fantastic entry. But he also proves that it's not at 51 West 67th Street. It's just a couple of houses down at 55 West 67th Street.
That's not bad, though.
55 West 67th Street was on the market on apartments.com in early May. It was available to be rented. The rent in the advertisement on apartments.com was starting at $2,600.
Oh, a steal.
Whereas rentcafe.com says the average monthly rent for an apartment in the Upper West Side averages at $4,600.
So yeah, that sounds more like
Bud says he makes $94.70 a week and that he pays $85 a week for the apartment, an extra $5 because of the secondhand air conditioner. That means he's paying almost all of his paycheck for this apartment. If you subtract 85 from 94.7, he has $9.70 for food and entertainment and anything else.
Is he paying weekly for the apartment, though, or is that his monthly rent?
He says per week.
Oh, he's paying weekly for the apartment.
Yeah.
I took away that he was getting paid weekly, and but his monthly rent was 80-something dollars.
Nope. It would be about $340 a month, which, according to a calculator, averages out at about, in 2020 money, $2,945. So, weirdly enough, it still costs about the same amount. But it also means that he in his desk job is only making $39,000 a year, which I don't think is possible to live in New York City in the Upper West Side on.
That's very interesting. And we don't really see him being financially compensated by any of these executives.
We see him recycling all those liquor bottles, which in and of itself must have cost more than the 970s making in a week. And Mr. Kirkaby saying,
yeah, well, lay in some vodka and some vermouth and put my name on it.
Yes, Mr. Kirkaby, you still owe me for the last two bottles.
Yeah, I'll pay you on Friday.
So he's in Hawk.
One of the interesting things that I responded to at first about this movie is that I found it very unbelievable. The whole situation seemed very contrived. But then in reading more about the movie and about Billy Wilder, he wrote the script, is that right?
He wrote it with a man named I.A.L. Diamond. Yes, the two of them co-wrote it.
Yeah, and that in fact, like, this had been inspired by a true story, like someone that they had known or somebody that Billy Wilder had known who had been in the situation, sort of like maybe a mutual acquaintance or something. I'm sure I'm botching this.
No, there are a couple of different stories about its origin story, and that's one of them.
Right, yeah, and so this is, you know, like one of those threads that got brought in and sort of incorporated into the plot, and I thought that was really fascinating. I was like, why, like, what executive would want to rent out something? Some shabby apartment, also one that was being used by multiple others for the same purpose. Like, gross. Why wouldn't you just go to a hotel like a normal, you know, adulterer? But then to find out that actually not only is it quite a thing to do, but had been done, and that was partially what inspired the movie. I thought that was very compelling, and also, you know, caused me to reflect again on sort of that era, and also, you know, things I learned from Mad Men, and also made me feel a little bit more sympathetic to Bud as a character in those early moments of the movie where I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, why would this guy ever agree to this? Why would he say yes? And why is he such a sniveling weasel that he feels compelled to bend over backwards when, you know, we see him sick and we see him unable to say no? And I sort of went back and forth feeling like, well, on the one hand, it makes a lot of sense because feeling like you're going to lose your job is quite a lot of pressure. Mm. On the other hand, he seems so profoundly unhappy with the arrangement, and it does not seem like such a huge ordeal to say no. And so I'm still not entirely sure if I have come to a conclusion on that, about whether it ultimately feels more contrived or not.
Well, then let's talk a little bit about Mr. Sheldrake, because he's the other major part of that conversation.
Yeah, let's talk about Mr. Sheldrake.
Because he's the one who manipulates Bud ultimately.
Ultimately.
We start off with the four different gentlemen who are all taking advantage of him.
And they're the worst. I hate them the most.
And Bud says to Miss Kubelik a couple of different times, he says,
well, Mr. Sheldrake wasn't using me. I was using him. See? Last month I was at desk 861 on the 19th floor, and now I'm on the 27th floor. Paneled office, three windows, so it all worked out fine.
You thought I was being took, but I was using them. This was always part of the plan.
Which is ridiculous.
But at the same time, the first time we hear the name Sheldrake is when Mr. Kirkaby comes back into the apartment to grab the galoshes. And he says, by the way, buddy boy, I put in a word with you at Sheldrake in personnel. And then when he calls Ray Walston's character because he left the wrong key under the mat, he's also got the chart, which he pulls out in front of him in a giant sweeping accordion.
And about your promotion. I'm sending that efficiency report right up to Mr. Sheldrake in personnel.
Which Sheldrake then, you see him open it up the same way when Bud's in his office, so that we know, we're never told, but we know based on the gesture that this is a direct result of the paperwork that's come from these people who've been dangling this carrot in front of him this whole time. So he is doing this in part because he's climbing up the corporate ladder, possibly with an idea that this is what he will do as well when he has the opportunity. That's where he starts to become querulously scummy, is we ask ourselves, does he have designs to also be part of the culture that he is victim towards?
Yeah.
And with Sheldrake in particular, when he calls him into his office, there's a moment where he's talking about the fact that
I know everything that goes on in this building, in every department, on every floor, every day of the year.
Tells him the story about the FBI being called in because somebody was running a bookie joint on the IBM machines, and Baxter freaks out.
You realize if this ever leaked out?
It won't! Believe me, it never again. Nobody is going to use my apartment from now on.
Baxter sees that his whole plan is being threatened, and he says, I'll drop all of it, but that's all part of Sheldrake's plan.
Where is your apartment, Baxter?
West 67th Street. You have no idea what I've been going through with the neighbors and the landlady and the liquor and the key and...
How do you work it with the key?
Sheldrake, we find out later when Baxter is talking to Kubelik in the lobby about going to Music Man. She says, he's been calling me for weeks trying to get a date, and I only just say yes. So she said yes, and then Sheldrake calls Baxter into his office to get the apartment. He's already got all these chess pieces in a row. He gets the other guys kicked out of the apartment so that he has exclusive apartment rights for Kubelik, and it's just his little love nest. Now, he doesn't have to deal with the warps of the other weird men in the building. It's just his secret. No bills, no hotel bills, no receipts, no way for him to get caught.
Right.
He just has power over a man who can't say no to him.
One way to get caught, and somebody who can ultimately say no to him, but yes.
Right, and that's the shift of the movie, is that he does actually have the ability to say no and does so because he cares more about doing the right thing and how it will hurt another person. It's mixed up there, and I think that gets back to our earlier point of the conversation. He's not purely heroic,
right?
But he does end up doing the right thing, even if it's not going to fix everything. He doesn't know if it's going to change the relationship between Kubelik and Sheldrake. He just knows that it's not going to be because he's allowing it to happen anymore. Mm-hmm. Similar to Miss Olsen, who watched women go in and out of that office for years after he dumped her, finally calls his wife and says, somebody needs to tell you.
Do you think that she should have called sooner?
Yes, 100%. Her character's interesting. She gets raked over the coals in reviews.
Really?
Yeah, people are not nice to her at all.
So interesting.
She generally is treated as very, and this is a word I don't like to use.
I'm excited.
Very bitchy.
Oh, yeah? So interesting. I actually, like, in sort of like watching the unfolding, I felt like because we see Sheldrake as unequivocally terrible, there's one scene where he's like, hey, I'm never going to leave my wife. He's having a private conversation where he's extremely candid.
Well, you know how it is. Sooner or later, they always give you a bad time.
Oh, I know how it is.
You know, you see a girl a couple of times a week just for laughs, and by the way, they think you're going to divorce your wife. No, I ask you, is that fair?
She thinks I'm going to leave my wife, but I'm never going to. Hey, I'm awesome. Terrible human being, right? Like, so terrible, it's comical. Like, it's grotesquely terrible. That makes it so when the secretary pulls Fran Kubelik aside, that action is not this catty thing. But I saw that as like, I know that you're in love with this guy. I have been there too.
Mm-hmm.
If we hadn't seen that moment with Sheldrake, like unequivocally being like, I'm never gonna leave my wife, we would still have this like uncertainty. I think with Mad Men, there was like a lot more of this like ambiguous, like, are they good? Are they bad? Do they love each other? Is adultery bad? Adults are complicated. They have complicated combinations of relationships. You know, sort of like you were talking before about broadcast news. You're like, grown-ups are complicated and hurt each other. You know, where this movie doesn't do that. Sheldrake, bad guy. No doubt about it. So for me, the Olsen character, the thing that's complicated about her is like, why didn't she quit? Like, why was she sitting out there for years? Mm-hmm. You know, and for you, I think the complication is like, why didn't she call the wife sooner? I think that those are fair criticisms, and I'm sure that people would have fair responses to that depending on, you know, the complexities of being in that kind of work environment and having a work affair, if you can call it a work affair and not...
not sexual harassment or sexual abuse of power.
Right, exactly. And I think that this movie is, it does not take us all the way there in the modern context which we understand those relationships, which is part of the reason why people would be likely to be like, oh yeah, Miss Olsen, like, so catty, am I right? But I definitely was grateful to Billy Wilder for adding this dimension to Sheldrake where it was very cut and dry so that we could see the other characters in their complexity. I think the complexity around Kubelik, around Baxter, is much more important, and we see that more closely, more clearly, because of the simplicity of some of these other characters.
I love that point. Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's like the anime tradition of having really simple backgrounds and no details until you need to focus in on something, and then you get a close-up of it. So by making him very flat of affect...
You're the best thing that ever happened to me.
That's enough, Fran. Just trust me, baby. We'll work it out somehow.
You're not being funny.
I wasn't trying.
Brian, if you'll just listen to me for a minute.
He took this part as a favor to Wilder. He'd been in a film of his called Double Indemnity years before, playing a bad guy. But he had just gotten a contract with Disney and was about to start being the lovable father on My Three Sons and ride that career out as being the most morally upright, wonderful dad character for years and years and years. And this part, he was desperately worried would derail his career with Disney. The fact that he still plays it that well says to me a degree about his commitment as an actor, that he doesn't shy away from what it might have done to him.
Absolutely. I think when he comes on the screen too, I'm sure that many people would be more familiar with him than I am, but I was like, don't I know that guy? I like him. What else has he been
right.
in? You know?
Right.
And that, yeah, he inspires a sense of likability. His face just seems like somebody you'd want to elect. In one of the reviews, I said Billy Wilder was casting him against type into this mm-hmm. role, which I think is another really brilliant element of the satire that Wilder, I mean, if you want to call it that, you know, or like social criticism, where
yes.
we sort of elevate men or, you know, people in power, executives, whomever, to this sort of untouchable place. And then other people have to suffer the consequences. People who are very vulnerable, in this case, Miss Kubelik and Mr. Baxter, they're not that, you know, they are just these people.
The devastating line that Kubelik says when they're in the apartment, well, she has a couple of devastating lines. The real terrible one, the one that is, again, right on the edge of violating the Hays Code, which you're not allowed to depict prostitution at this point. And so when he gives her $100 for a Christmas present and she takes off her coat and he goes,
look, Fran, I didn't realize it was so late. It's 7:15. I mustn't miss my train. If we hadn't wasted all this time, I have to get home and trim the tree.
Okay. I just thought as long as it was paid for.
And the look that she has before that is there's so much hate in her face for the fact that she's gotten him a gift that reflects their secret life together and he's gotten her money mm-hmm. is awful. I've neglected to calculate how much $100 is, but considering that $94.70, his weekly wages is... We figured that out. I think somebody else could probably figure it out pretty aptly. But
yeah, I didn't think about that. It's not nothing, but that doesn't make it better.
No. Right before that is when she's crying and she says,
let me see. There was Miss Olsen, and then there was Miss Rossi. No, she came before. Miss Koch came after Miss Olsen.
No, Fran.
And just think, right now some lucky girl in the building is going to come after me.
And that he has been treating the job like it's his sex sandbox and he can just wander in there and find the next person. That is one of the perks of his privilege. And I learned a term this week, which is called bluebearding. The verb bluebeard means to seduce and reject one woman after another after another. And it's come up because of some major social media occurrences right before the time of this recording of the revelations of some abusive relationships, particularly in the entertainment and the comics worlds, of people who've used their power to mentor and groom young people and then discard them when they were no longer useful because there will always be more young people who will be stepping up to the plate of being starstruck by influence.
Yeah.
For example, there's a pretty damning chart out there about how no matter how old he is, Leonardo DiCaprio has never dated anyone over 24.
What? That's unfortunate. That's really unfortunate.
Yes.
I was going to say that's hard to believe, but I'm not in the mood to dispute. Yeah.
And that's exactly what Sheldrake is in this. He is he's a bluebeard. He has a wife and then he puts her in the blood room and gets another one and tells her, don't use that key. And it's only by giving up the key to the apartment that we are able to sidestep that fate in this circumstance.
I had not heard this term before. I would be curious to learn more about this this word and how people are showing what their experience is. It's very hard.
But I think that's why Miss Olsen is important, is that she's able to talk to Miss Kubelik and say, we don't talk about this. I know all of the women who have walked in and out of that office. I can't swear to their experiences, but here's mine, and here's what I think yours is. and she's right, which is why Miss Kubelik does what she does, because she's despairing at being part of a pattern.
I feel sad just talking about this. It's been interesting to watch this movie and to reflect on, I think it was like 2017 when Me Too started trending as a hashtag, and that so much has changed since then. You know, even in the course of the conversation, it's very clear that a lot of this movie is no longer okay. You know, even from 5 years ago, I think a lot of this has changed. But still, we have a long way to go. It sounds very trite, but but I think that even now we're still talking about some things, and maybe like Miss Kubelik, you know, and the way that she like glosses over sexual harassment, that we're not...
But in general, that a movie that's 60 years old can still feel emotionally resonant today and can actually therefore show in part that we haven't made as much progress as we might have wanted to hope that we'd made, especially with comparison to something like Mad Men, where it really felt like, oh, that's in the past. We've moved on from this. But maybe this movie is showing that we haven't made as much progress as we'd liked to claim.
Totally. And honestly, you know, when I was sort of starting out with this movie, I was like, oh, this movie is so ahead of its time. But now the more that I talk, I'm like, maybe we are just so far behind where we should be. And this movie highlights that, you know, that Billy Wilder in 1960 was like, yo, you paying attention? Because I am. And here's a way that that looks. All of these things that are ready to be satirized in terms of men in power. And I just think that it was and is a really brilliant movie in a lot of those ways, and that it's 60 years later and some of those things are still completely unaddressed is that's a hard pill to swallow, I guess.
On that note, let's move on to our minute summary, which I don't have a catchy apartment-themed name for. Using the random number generating power of random.org, I have found a minute between 1 and 125. The movie is 2 hours, 5 minutes, and something seconds long. And so we generated a random minute. Anna is going to watch a 60-second clip. She will then have 30 seconds to summarize what takes place during the minute. And then I will ask her 5 quiz questions related to the content of that minute.
Okay.
Anna, are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm so ready.
Well, first you can't wait to get me here, and then it's rush, rush, rush. Makes a person feel cheap.
Sylvie, sweetie, it's not that, but I promised the guy I'd be out of here by 8 o'clock positively.
Having watched the 60 seconds of video, Anna now has 30 seconds to summarize it, and her time begins now.
Okay, so we see one of the executives in Baxter's apartment with one of the women that he's having an affair with. They're finishing off what looks like a pitcher of martinis. They're getting ready to leave. Then we see Bud on the street. He's coming home. He's in the rain. His neighbor walks up and says, hey, how's it going?
10 seconds left.
He won't go upstairs. She's like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm waiting for a friend. And then they come out of the apartment and she's like,
and
I live in
the Bronx.
I need a countdown. I need a countdown next time. Oh man, it was a really good scene, everybody. I'm sorry I failed you. It was really funny. I got too distracted.
It is a good scene. It's interesting in that it's mostly just sort of quiet character stuff. It's one of the scenes that shot actually in New York City. They began filming on November 17th in 1959 in NYC, and they hated the weather so much that they then moved to LA and they rebuilt the street in LA on a soundstage and then built the apartment in its interior on a set. None of that is what we're talking about during the quiz. No, I'm going to concentrate on the fact that when Mrs. Lieberman comes in off the street walking her dog, Oscar, she says, I suppose that the weather is being influenced by all the Michigas down at Cape Canaveral, because we are in prime space race territory here in 1959-1960. On February 6th, 1959, it was the first successful launch of a Titan intercontinental ballistic missile. And between 1956 and 1962, there were 49 launches and 2 explosions. in NASA. And so I am going to ask Anna 5 multiple choice questions about the space race that nobody would have any possible reason to know what the answers were.
And don't forget about my bonus point. Yep. To start with.
So she only needs to get 2 points to win, because you need 3 to win, and she's starting with an amazing bonus.
I earned it.
Here we go. Question 1. Speaking of beatniks, the first Sputnik satellite launched on October 1st, 1957, and Nick then got added on as a shorthand for various things in the space race. Which of the following is a fake? When Laika the dog was shot into space, it was dismissively called Mutnik. B. When the U.S. failed to launch their Vanguard TV-3 satellite and it fell to the Earth within view of reporters, they called it Kaputnik. Or C, when John Glenn had his first splashdown water landing, the capsule was called Splatnik. Oh.
Kaputnik.
I'm sorry.
No!
You were going to say Splatnik, and that is correct. That is the one that I made up. Question number 2. On May 28th, 1959, 2 monkeys were shot into orbit. The monkeys were named Abel and Baker. Their names came from A, an older phonetic alphabet used by the Army and Navy, much like Alpha Bravo Charlie, except this was Abel Baker Charlie. B, each of the monkeys was chosen from a batch of contenders. The rhesus macaques were named for Genesis, Adam, Eve, Cain, and Abel. And the squirrel monkeys were named for counting rhymes, Butcher, Baker, Candlestick Maker. Or C, they were named after composers Carl Friedrich Abel and Richard Baker. Monkeys named after Purcell, Corelli, and Telamon did not make the cut.
I don't know. B sounded just very plausible.
Unfortunately, it's A.
Oh, no.
Before Alpha Bravo was adopted by NATO in 1956, Abel Baker were the first 2 letters of the phonetic alphabet.
Well, you're very good at thinking up fake multiple choices.
All right, well, here's a simple one. 1959,
<Don't say that.
laughs> Russian Luna 1 was finally able to escape the gravitational field, even though it missed the moon. And the U.S. was finally able to launch their first spy satellite, also in 1959. There were 23 launches in 1959. How many were partially or totally unsuccessful out of that 23? 19, 16, or 13?
Why did you say this was simple?
Because there's no trickery. It's just a number. You just have to randomly pick a number between 0 and 23. But I'm saying you only have to pick 19, 16, or 13.
How many were unsuccessful?
Correct.
16.
Unfortunately, it was only 13 that were partially or totally unsuccessful.
Oh my gosh.
Question number 4. In order to track spacecraft, various relay capcoms have to be established in order to account for the rotation of the globe. One of such was located in Woomera, South Australia. What fact about Woomera does graphic novelist Jim Ottaviani encourage readers to discover in his comic book about the space race, T-? A. It has a gem mine named after the local geologic feature called Peculiar Knob. B. It is named after a piece of wood that Aboriginal men used to launch spears. Or C. Woomera no longer exists because it was destroyed by a riverbed flooding in 1971, and a piece of spaceflight history has been totally destroyed.
I think that you are too good at making fake multiple choices. I want to say, for the permanent record, I am usually very good at figuring out multiple choice just by the way they are written. And
but I am the Bud Baxter of lying on quizzes.
Yes, this is not fun. This is not good.
All right, well, think of it this way, good at figuring out quizzes. The answers so far have been C-A-C.
No, that never works. And now I feel like you're trying to throw me off. Get into my head and be like, well, it's probably B then.
Yes, it is. Congratulations.
And I'm glad you cut me off before I could
walk that one back. Yeah.
It's a what? Will you read it again? It's a what?
It's a piece of wood that Aboriginal men, never women, use to launch a spear further distance than they would be able to throw it normally. That is what a Woomera is.
Wow.
Final question. Shirley MacLaine has been roundly criticized for her beliefs in reincarnation. But her memoirs also have revealed her convictions about human extraterrestrial contact. So our final question about the space race is not about the space race at all. Which of the three following is true? In 2008, in her book, Saging While Aging, she tells the story of a friend who was abducted and mutilated by aliens, but then claims that aliens prefer to be called, quote, star visitors, and are here to help and teach us. B. In her 2016 book, Above the Line, My Wild Oats Adventures, she reveals that while undergoing hydrotherapy to recover repressed past life memories, the star people showed her that Atlantis became the Canary Islands when it sank. Or C. In Lucky Me, the 2013 memoir by MacLaine's daughter, Sachi Parker, Parker claims that her father was able to get MacLaine to send her an additional $60,000 a month because he claimed he was secretly a clone of an astronaut slash extraterrestrial named Paul.
Oh, B.
They're all correct. You couldn't get that one wrong. Which means you get 3 points. Congratulations. Then on that note,
yes,
we will move ahead to our 5 favorite moments of the movie. As a reminder, a moment is not a whole scene. It's not a sketch. It's just, it can be a glance, an interpretation, an inflection, a sentence, something that makes us smile or think or appreciate the craft of filmmaking. Anna, do you want to start or do you want me to start?
You should go first.
I will say that this is a tiny little actorly thing, but I'd never noticed it before, and it jumped out at me on this particular rewatching, is that Ms. Olsen's, the actress who plays her, Edie Adams, when she's calling Mrs. Sheldrake's phone number, she doesn't have to look it up because she's called it so many times on Mr. Sheldrake's behalf. But she mouths the numbers silently to herself.
Mm.
And it's such a marvelous, realistic detail. I don't believe it's in the script. The commentary track for the Blu-ray was obsessed with pointing out that much of the tiny details that one appreciates are in the script. They weren't developed on set. They were pre-planned. They were part of the basic idea in the first place. But that moment to me was somebody well observed, knowing what certain people do when they're on the phone. She doesn't say it out loud because that would be distracting to the other women in the office. She just silently says the numbers as she dials them. And I thought it was a brilliant choice.
I love that.
What's number 2, Anna?
I really loved the fully inappropriate office party of my dreams scene. Especially, there's this really great moment where this lady is doing like a faux striptease with this sort of beaded necklace. And I was like, yeah, no longer. Like, you can barely have an office party with alcohol, let alone like this like full blown, you know, like basically the lampshade on your head sort of classic people fully letting go. And it was definitely like one of those era moments of source material, Christmas time in New York sorts of things that I just relish about watching these old movies with you, Ben.
For number 3, I will mention that when Baxter gets out of the elevator and he's just gotten the carnation from Miss Kubelik, she's taken a moment to dandy him up before his interview. She knows that he's going to see Mr. Sheldrake. We've never met Sheldrake at this point, but she has. And she gives him a little something to make him nice for the person she's about to see, that she has intimate knowledge as to what he likes. But she also says,
good luck, and wipe your nose.
Whirls her hand around and sort of magic spells the elevator back down in her quirky way. And then he goes to the glass door of the office and is fixing his appearance in the reflection before he understands that everyone in the office is looking at him because it's a transparent door.
Oh, man.
And it's so good. It's such a funny moment. And the lighting is perfect because you can see his reflection and you can see Miss Olsen through a part of the glass that doesn't have a reflection in it. And nobody comments on it. It's just done and gone. And oh, it really made me happy.
Yeah. What a goober. Your observations are always so much deeper, I guess, because you've seen the movies before.
I do have a little bit of an advantage that I get to concentrate on little details because I have watched this movie many, many times.
That is a really good one, though. There's a lot of layers there. A scene that I really liked. Okay, so honorable mention, since I think this will be my last one, to the tiki bar. I'm sorry if I'm taking it.
Yeah, yeah, the Chinese restaurant, which I believe is called the Rickshaw.
Oh, okay, got it. So fabulous. Okay, but that's my honorable mention. People can go see that for themselves. But I cannot leave this list without mentioning the scene where on Christmas Eve, our Bud Baxter is at this bar and he's so drunk that he does not realize that this lady who has eyes for him is shooting these straw wrappers at him by means of courtship.
So, yeah, we haven't talked at all about the fact that he tries to take Mrs. Margie McDougal home. He's like, everybody else has had sex in my apartment. I might as well have sex in my apartment. But he gets picked up by her. And yes, you're describing her perfectly. She's sitting there. He's drunkenly sad-sacking his way through martini after martini after martini. And she's blowing straw wrappers to get his attention.
And she cannot. So she goes and she sidles up to him. And I think what she says is,
you buy me a drink, I'll buy you some music.
Right. She puts a quarter in the jukebox and he spends a dollar on a martini. But there's that fabulous scene of him just sitting there with straw wrappers falling on his hat brim and in front of him.
She blows one and nothing. Not to be fazed, she tries again.
It breaks the rule of three. She does it four times, which is one of the perfect things about that scene is everyone knows there's a comedy rule. You do something three times.
Absolutely.
But that joke lands particularly because they do it a fourth time before she gives up and walks over to him.
I thought that it captured so much. I loved her character and I liked that feeling of Christmas for everyone who does not have a normal Christmas to have. Mm.
Was the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring. Nothing. No action. Dullsville.
You know, people who do end up at a bar, or people who are like her, you know, away from, I think her husband is
In prison in Cuba.
Exactly. Hilarious. So many great little details woven throughout the whole script. But for everyone who has a forlorn Christmas or a Christmas that just doesn't match up with every other Christmas movie, I think it's that kind of moment and those kinds of details. And it is a unconsummated Christmas affair, spoiler alert, but an absolutely wonderful addition to that Christmas moment.
Played by Hope Holiday in the film, the movie was made into a musical by Neil Simon, and it was called Promises, Promises, and I've never liked it from a script level. One of the dumb things I don't like about it is that they change his name. He's no longer C.C. Baxter, call me Bud, C for Calvin, C for Clifford. They call him Chuck Baxter. And I can't, it's so stupid, but I can't get around the fact, Chuck! No, he's not Chuck. And it grinds my gears to listen to the dialogue calling him Chuck. And it's stupid, but I'm stupid for not being able to get around it. But in the most recent revival that was done in New York City in 2010 with Kristen Chenoweth and Sean Hayes in the lead roles, the actress Katie Finneran played the part of Margie McDougal and apparently was hilarious. And for those of you who don't know Katie Finneran, I do recommend that you seek her out in the sadly canceled television show Wonderfalls, where she plays a closeted gay woman to great comic effect. And I can only imagine that she brings some of that same humorous energy to the part of Margie, which is done so well by Hope Holliday in the original.
So. Just want to reassure you that your intuition is correct about his name. I think it's important that his name is Bud because it speaks to his everyman essence that is part of what is so important about this plot.
Yeah. Chuck. To me, Chuck is the wrong name for Charlie Brown, and it's the wrong name for C.C. Baxter.
It could be any name. It doesn't have to be Bud. It just can't be Chuck.
For my final brief moment, speaking of people who call up old Buddy Boy on the phone and call him Bud, the actor Ray Walston, who was made famous for My Favorite Martian, plays one of the terrible men who's taking advantage of him. And Walston calls from a bar while Bud has just taken a sleeping pill and says, "I've just need it for 45 minutes. You won't believe this girl. She looks just like Marilyn Monroe." And this woman turns around and taps on the glass of the phone booth and says,
"Lonely. Who are you talking to anyway?"
"My mother."
"Oh, that's sweet. That's real sweet."
And she just has this hilarious, like, over-the-top, sultry, breathy, like, in my opinion, just her whole character is based around the idea of this woman is trading on faking being like Marilyn Monroe so that people will pick her up. And the way that Walston goes, "I'm talking to my mother," in the least nice way possible. And it doesn't matter. She's so boozy and so in it. She's just like, "Oh, that's so sweet." Walston is great. The actress is great. The hilarious takedown of Marilyn Monroe, who was just in Billy Wilder's earlier movie, that he gets to have his revenge on this actress that both made him millions of dollars and made his life hell for a year. All of that is wrapped up in this scene, and it makes me really happy every time I watch it.
I really want to see outtakes of that actress, like, doing her, like, working over her Marilyn Monroe, you know, sitting around with her friends being like, hold on, wait, let me, hey.
This episode of The Python Perspective was conceived, researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and special co-host Anna Withington. Our logo was designed by Liana Emily. Special thanks to you, Liana. The theme song is adapted by the music from Deutsch. What's his first name? Help me out here, Deutschy. Yep, had this tab open, no longer have this tab open. Alfred Deutsch. Hopefully I'm not too wrong about that. And you can find us on pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PythonPod. And I asked you again last time, do you want to have people follow you on Instagram?
Yeah, you can at me at Anna Withington.
This podcast is an intellectual exploration of comic phenomenon, but if there are names, dates, facts, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on pythonperspective.com as soon as possible. Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Ben. My co-host is Anna. Thank you, Anna, for coming in again in this wild experiment.
Thanks, Ben. Any old time.
And we'll see you possibly in September for the second series of Monty Python's Flying Circus, or potentially in the interim. If this episode drops on time on June 30th, then remember that tomorrow, July 1st, is the 100th anniversary of the original serial publication of The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. So go out there. Speaking of books that are about high-class people dealing with beatniks, there's a whole thing with Newland Archer dealing with counterculture artists, and that's one of the ways it shows that he's not like everybody else in his rootin'-tootin' high-class family. Go do yourself a favor and pretend that somebody didn't force you to read Ethan Frome in high school and give Age of Innocence a try. We'll see you next time.